Hey Nikki, how's it going? How you doing?
Good, good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I'm really enjoying these lighter mornings, I have to say. I'm a bit of an early bird in the mornings, and it's become really noticeable how much earlier it is getting lighter now. So that is very nice. It feels like you're really on the run into summer once that happens. But of course, we've got the clocks changed, which will change that a little bit as well.
Yeah, for me, I'm more into the lighter evenings, more of a night owl.
Right. So you're more supportive of the clock change, I think, which is coming up, which will flip it back that way, I guess, for a little bit. It's all going in the right direction anyway into the summer. Been up to much recently, the weekend sort of thing? Anything worth mentioning?
So I went to see Bonnie and Clyde musical. It's around until end of April for those that want to see it.
Oh, you did? Oh, great. You a regular theatre goer then?
Yeah, probably once a month or so.
Oh, that's pretty regular, I'd say. Yeah. So is it a recommend?
Yeah, I would say so. It was good production, very good acting, and pretty good singing as well.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, I hardly ever go actually to theatre, but yeah, that's a good one to get on my list. If that's a hard recommend from a theatre goer, that's great.
Yeah, I've seen most of them, so definitely go see this one. And how was your weekend? Did you get up to much?
Yeah, good, great. I had sort of a little night out there. I don't go out that much these days with two very young kids, but I had a bit of a day out, I suppose, to watch the rugby on TV with some mates, which was a lot of fun. A few Guinnesses and that sort of stuff. So yeah, enjoyed the rugby.
And what teams were playing? Knowing nothing about rugby?
It was the final weekend of the Six Nations, which is a tournament that runs for a couple of months at this time of year. It was England, Wales, Scotland, France, and Ireland, and Italy that were playing. Ireland won the Grand Slam, as many folks will know. They beat England, but that was kind of expected. It was fun, and it's been a good tournament, I think. The previous weekend, it was England v France, which is always a big day in our household because my wife's French and our boys are half English, half French. So it's always an interesting one. They had both English and French jerseys to support, but listeners may or may not know what the result of that match was. So there's probably not a load further we need to talk about that, really.
So is there only one winner? Is there second and third place?
There is a second and third place, exactly. Yes, Ireland won and France were second. And they were the best two teams by quite a long way. Scotland were third. Probably a fair reflection of where all the teams were. And of course, all the talk is about the World Cup later this year, which is really exciting, and about the build-up into that.
And are you going to that?
We got a few tickets, yeah. Some of the games that are out in Bordeaux. So to see what's your weekend end up going to. It's over in France, so it's reasonably accessible.
Nice.
But it was a good story for the Irish. St. Patrick's Day, they won the Grand Slam. I imagine it was quite a big party in Dublin. So well done to the Irish. And I suppose it's been a nice quiet week in the markets, hasn't it, really, as we've been back this week? Not really much going on, is there?
Yeah, just a few banks, I hear, maybe having issues.
Yeah, a few banks here and there. I mean, I'm sure folks will have heard a lot about that already, so we're not planning to go into loads of detail, and I guess it'll all be changed by the time you'll be hearing this anyway. But yeah, lots going on there at the moment. Should we talk about the episode quickly then? Give out a quick preview?
Yeah, sounds good.
So we wanted to do something a bit different with this one. It's not a sort of markets asset class-based episode. We wanted to have a chat about leadership and decision making. And one thing that I felt for a while is that the military and the army offer a lot of really interesting lessons on leadership and decision making, which can be a bit underappreciated. So we're talking to Langley Sharp, who used to be an officer in the army and now runs his own leadership consultancy. So what were some of the things that stuck out to you from talking to Langley, Nikki?
I think where he was saying acknowledging the emotions that he had helped him move forwards with decisions, that was really useful. Also practicing a number of things before putting them into place, so going on autopilot when the real situation arises was particularly useful for him.
Drilling, he called it, yeah, and getting that just happening naturally. Yeah, those are really interesting points. And yeah, for me, it was just how relatable some of the decision-making aspects will be to a lot of other people, albeit the military operates in a much more extreme environment than what any of us ever would, but how actually transferable some of that stuff is. Should we get on with it?
Let's do it.
Cool. All right, here we go.
Welcome to Investment Uncut.
In Investment Uncut, we cut through the noise when it comes to investing. We're digging deeper to try and bring clarity to your investment decisions. I'm Dan Mikulskis.
And I'm Mary Spencer. Investment Uncut is brought to you by the investment team at LCP. LCP provide investment advice to some of the largest institutional investors in the UK, including pension funds, wealth managers, and sovereign funds. Find out more at lcp.uk.com.
Hi, everybody. Well, today we are talking leadership and decision making. And we're actually talking to someone who's from quite a different field and background to the investment world. So today we're delighted to welcome Langley Sharp, founder and director of Frontier Leadership Consultancy and a former lieutenant colonel in the parachute regiment. Langley, welcome.
Dan, Nikki, very good morning. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
If you could give us a sense of your role and background, both current and former, that would be really great.
Yeah, sure, Nicky. So I joined the army 23 years ago. I was kind of persuaded by a friend, had always had an interest, but I never had clear aspirations of joining the army and having a big long career. Even when I joined, I thought I'd do 5 years and then get out and get a proper job. And there I was 23 years later, still plugging away, and feel very fortunate, as Dan's head, I managed to get into the parachute regiment, and I served there pretty much for the bulk of my career in various roles up to, as Dan said, lieutenant colonel. So I commanded a parachute regiment battalion, one of our three regular battalions later on in my career. But I had the fortune of serving in all three battalions, serving in operations around the world, 9 operational tours. And the culmination of my time in the military the last 2 years was as the head of the Center for Army Leadership. So I had the pleasure of sort of 20 plus years of practical leadership experience, but then to dedicated time towards the end of my career to really consolidate my thinking about what leadership means to me, to us as an organization. And that was a small team that was set up about 7 years ago to do the thinking on behalf of the army about what leadership really means to us as an organization, and to have that debate and discussion with others outside of the military so we can learn from one another. And so when I left the army in May of last year, really for family reasons, to settle the family, and sacrificed enough, I left on a high, but it was time to pay back to the family. And I decided to go into or maintain my interest in the leadership world. So hence set up a leadership consultancy, which is where I am today.
Brilliant. Cool. Well, we're going to get into a whole load more stuff around that, I think, which can be great. Just kick us off. Why don't you tell us something we should know about you that we wouldn't find on your CV?
One thing that wouldn't be on my CV is that I keep pigs, or we as a family keep pigs. We've got a couple of moments. We started about 10 years ago, actually, when we moved into our house, albeit being away for the best part of 10 years as the military has taken us in various places. So we used to get them every year or so and then give them a good life, and then they'd end up in the freezer, and we'd make it economically viable by selling the sausages, langers, bangers. So we're back to square one now. We've got a couple of pigs having a good life in the field.
Are they quite easy animals to keep? I mean, they don't strike me as the most domesticated, sort of thing.
Really easy. We had pigs and chickens before. In fact, we got some chickens down. And I think there's a thing about sheep. They spend every day trying to kill themselves, whereas pigs are very robust. They're great animals, very intelligent. And yeah, let's just get on with it.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm not sure how to pivot from pig to leadership.
that's nothing to do with the leadership whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with it. And I guess, Lanny, to get us started, I mean, you've clearly been in big leadership roles. It sounds like you've thought and reflected an awful lot about leadership within the army. You've written a book about leadership and you now teach it and discuss it with companies and things. So I suppose one obvious question might be why? Why study leadership? Why do you think it matters?
That's a really valuable question, actually. It's probably the question that all companies, teams should be starting with. You know, why do we care about leadership? I often say that it's fundamental to success. It's a force multiplier that enables people's teams, organizations to perform at their best, really. And I think in terms of why does it matter to your organization, whoever you're part of, I think it's also worth going back to your purpose and why you exist and trying to understand that relationship. So let me just expand on that, because I often talk about this from a military perspective and then I sort of translate it across, because everything leadership is translatable. We all talk the same game. I often say the fundamentals endure, it's just the context that changes. So the military context, and look through this from the prism of the profession of arms, is that why do we exist? Ultimately, we exist to protect our nation and our national interest, which means in the extreme, we are required to fight on behalf of the state. Well, what does that mean? It means that when we sign up and volunteer to serve, we effectively sign a covenant of unlimited liability, as it's known, which is the legal right and duty in extremis to take life or indeed sacrifice one's own, which puts immeasurable pressures on decision makers at all levels of the organization, whether it be soldiers fighting on the front line in the heat of the battle or senior decision makers developing the operational plans and the strategies and that put people in harm's way. And therefore, leadership is critical to ensure that people are not only just performing at their best, but the decisions, and I'm sure we'll come on, as you said, to decision making, but the decision people are making are the right ones. And by that, I mean they are, of course, legally robust, but also morally robust as well. And so that's why leadership is so important. The second thing I'd say is that, contrary to the picture that Hollywood often paints, that war is all about death and destruction, war in reality is a contest of wills. And as Sun Tzu said many centuries ago, if you can undermine the will of your enemy without fighting, then all the better. And of course, so there's an element of that, but it's also about protecting and enhancing the will of your own people. When their sort of natural human instinct is to go in one direction, you need them to go into the fight. And that motivation takes more than just giving orders and telling people what to do, which is often what people think military leadership is all about. Ultimately, it's about motivating people to do something that's
utterly unnatural when they're literally putting their lives on the line. And to enable that motivation, you need to have mutual trust and respect, which is built up in the, you know, days, weeks, months, years before you actually get into the arena, so to speak. And so I think there's some translatable bits. Clearly, that context is quite different to the world of finance or business, but certainly decision-making under pressure, motivating people, people can relate to. But the one thing why I would say everyone absolutely realigns on is the fact that regardless of the game you're in, regardless of the business, regardless of the industry, we're all about people. Because it's people who drive the strategy, make the operational plans, engage with the customers, make those decisions, analyze the data. It's all about people, right? Of course, technology has increasing role to play, but it's ultimately about people. And people need to be well-led for two reasons. One, because we have the moral obligation to look after people, to develop them and get the very best out of them. And second, and inextricably linked, if you get the best and unleash the latent potential of every single individual in your organization as a collective, you're going to deliver higher performance. And therefore, your competitive advantage, your operational effectiveness is going to be enhanced. So leadership is fundamental to how we do business and succeed.
It's a people thing, I guess, is the point. And that's the commonality to everything.
Absolutely. That's what combines us all. And that's why it's all so transferable, because it's all about people at the end of the day, because they're the ones that ultimately deliver whatever product or services we're providing.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I mean, you sort of alluded to it there. What are some of the things that might surprise people about the military's approach to leadership? I've had a little bit of exposure to these ideas over the years. And I guess my preconception of how the military leadership works is sort of very hierarchical. You have someone at the top who sort of issues these orders, which sort of come down like lightning bolts or whatever. And people ask to jump and they say how high kind of thing. And that's basically it. But from what I understand, from what I've read in your book and stuff, that is kind of not really how it works. Help unpack that for me and how it sort of really works.
Yeah, that's the classic misperception. There is an element of reality to that. We do have a clear hierarchy, a rank structure, and that is important for us because it ensures that there's clarity and alignment where authority is held is clear. But the reality is that's a sort of very old age, industrial age way of operating. Again, this reflects across the business as well, and perhaps we can get into some of that. But the complexity of the battlefield and the modern battlefield particularly just doesn't allow for that rather stifled, slow, inagile way of operating. The other thing to look at is we distinguish between command leadership and management. So command is the authority that's invested in individuals in a rank, a title, a position. And with that, of course, comes responsibility and accountability. Management is more about process. It's about managing people, time, resources. And leadership is that people skills, that social relationship between leader and led that influences people to achieve a particular outcome. Now, of course, although we define them differently, they all interrelate. So if you're in a position of command, you, of course, have to manage resources and people, and you have to lead them. But you don't have to be in a position of command or authority to lead. Anyone can lead. You can lead by example. An intern, soldier on day one can lead by example and influence others. And I think that those distinctions are quite clear. So yes, we have a clear command structure, but to motivate people and get the very best out of people, it really does take leadership, certainly as a collective. Just as a sort of personal story, it first dawned on me on day one when I first met my platoon. So 5 Platoon B Company 2 Para, this battalion within a regiment with this great history going back to World War II. I'd just come out of 18 months of training and I turned up and they were 4 months into a 6-month tour in Northern Ireland. And there was me all fresh-faced and eager. I turned up and walked into the room to meet my platoon for the first time. And I was introduced as Second Lieutenant Sharp, your new platoon commander, and I had 30 sets of eyes of these gruff, roughy paratroopers staring at me. I often say I felt the weight of judgment in the air. You can just imagine what they must have been thinking. Now, who is this young upstart? Is he going to be good at his job? Critically, is he going to look after us? Has he got our interests at heart? That's what people want to know. Can we trust him? And I guess at that point, it really dawned on me that I'm in command of these people. I have the legal responsibility for these people. The decisions I make, indeed the decisions they make, ultimately I'm held responsible for, particularly on operations. That's quite a pressure, right? But every single person in that room, even the newest private soldier, had 4 months ahead of me. And my platoon sergeant was a Falklands veteran. He'd been in 20 years, 5-6 operational tours and all the lines. So every single person in that room had more experience than me. And there I was supposed to be in command of them. And yet I had to lead them. And of course, that leadership takes time because you've got to build up that mutual trust and respect and that relationship that now enables you to sort of motivate and influence people. For me, that was a real stark reality between command and leadership and how it goes back to the fundamentals of what British Army leadership is about. It's values-based. So it's our leaders living our values every single day, setting the example. It's servant in nature. So it's looking after your people, putting their needs first. And then it's about sort of empowering your people, setting an example and empowering your people to be the best. And we can probably explore some of those, but long answer to a short question. But you're right, it's not about hierarchy and people shouting at each other. It's about motivating people and getting the best out of them, the foundations of trust ultimately.
And have you seen the approach to leadership change over the years? Are the skills required now different to what they were before? And does that depend on the sort of people that you're managing? Has that changed in some way?
So historically, yeah. And in fact, in the book that Dan mentioned, that myself and the team at the Centre of Army Leadership published a couple of years ago. So in that, the first chapter is about the history of British Army leadership. And I think actually it reflects, we learned through research, it reflects the changes in society. And of course, the military reflects society we serve, right? We recruit from it. What do I mean by that? So if you look back sort of 200 years, Duke of Wellington, that everyone knows him, is a great historical leader, beating Napoleon at Waterloo. And really, he typified what leadership meant, certainly in the military, but also more broadly in society. So the early Industrial Revolution, it was about leaders were born, not made. They came from the aristocracy. They bought their commission. They were wealth and status. It was about honor and physical courage and discipline. That's how they instilled leadership in those days. Very, very hierarchical, very command and control. And then, of course, you had the Industrial Revolution came along and they had greater access to wealth, health, education, the emergence of the middle classes. And that sort of pattern has continued through into the 20th century and almost sort of flattening of society, greater empowerment all the way through society. Clearly, advances made in the First and Second World War with the sort of mass mobilization of people meant that people from what traditionally were seen as the lower classes moving up into the officer ranks, which were the decision makers at the time and were seen as the leaders, to where we are today. And today's a very different approach. Leadership is an all ranks business. It's not just officers. And it's much more about, as I say, sort of getting the best out of all your people. It's not a hierarchical thing. And I think that reflects the changes in society. If you think of the power that people have for literally the end of their fingertips now, the access to massive information and therefore the ability to influence, and the great social changes, political changes that happened certainly since World War II, people are far more empowered than ever before, which naturally creates a different relationship between leader and led. It's far more symbiotic, far more collaborative. And therefore, we need now and have got leaders that understand that across all sectors, that understand that, but also understand the value that people, regardless of their seniority in the organization, the value that people offer. And it's about unleashing that value for the collective good, I guess. So I think it's a far more collaborative approach. So I'd say that that's how leadership has changed, and that social relationship is more nuanced than it ever has been.
That's a really fascinating little sort of historical tour there. But one thing I read sometimes is that people say that a lot of the kind of structures around corporations and hierarchies are actually hangovers from the Industrial Revolution, really, which is obviously when the idea of the corporation sort of took off. It was like, I suppose, one of the innovations of that period of time. Do you think that's true, that when you work with businesses, you find a lot of things that are really just a hangover from there that just need to be completely retooled for a flatter, more agile, decentralized world?
I wouldn't say necessarily retooled, I'll say why, but yeah, absolutely. The structures, in many cases, the cultures and the way of leading are remnants of the industrial age. Clear lines of authority, people have their skills and responsibilities. And now, of course, the complexity of the world, the interconnectivity, the pace of change requires a different approach. So yes, it requires everything we all talk about, agility, innovation, creativity, unleashing the power of your people, et cetera, et cetera. But hierarchies, I think hierarchies will always exist. They're a social phenomenon. And hierarchies have their place because, again, it ensures clear lines of authority, ensures alignment. But how you use that authority and how you use the hierarchies within your organization has to change, and it needs to be flatter, it needs to be more agile than perhaps it was. I'm not an advocate of getting away with hierarchies and completely flat structures, because I don't think that's quite realistic. You've still got your CEOs and your bosses and your executives, and all the way down to those new to a company but lacking experience, and you've got all those layers in between. But how you use those structures and how you empower people, how you distribute power across your organization has to and is changing. And again, that just takes quality leadership across the organization, leadership at all levels. We're not just talking about senior decision makers here, senior leaders. It's leadership across every rank and grade all the way down through the organization.
Would you say it's more important today to know your team and what drives them so that you can lead them more effectively than it was in the past?
Yeah, you need to understand your people. I mean, if you look again, there are historical examples of great leaders of old knew their people. It's not as if this is a whole new way of working. To get the best out of your team in any environment, you genuinely need to know your people. If you're going to motivate them, if you're going to inspire them, if you're going to get the best out of them, we're all different. by our very nature, we've all had different journeys. All three of us had different journeys to sit in the seats we're in today. And we've all got our strengths and weaknesses and biases and aspirations and hopes and dreams and whatever it may be. And so, yeah, you need to know your people. So in the army, we talk about what leaders are, know and do. And the know bit is about knowing your people as well as your profession. But knowing your people is actually critical, and knowing yourself as well. If you're talking about a social relationship between leader and led, it starts with you, the leader. So you've got to know yourself. You've got to know how you think and feel and your biases and strengths and weaknesses and how you act under pressure and how your behavior changes and how you're feeling in that moment. Because, of course, that impacts on your relationship with someone else. But you're absolutely right, Nikki. You've got to know your people. And that's what we often say, that leadership is so contextual. And part of that context is the people you're working with. They will change day to day in terms of their responses and their behaviors. So, yeah, to get the best out of your people, you've got to know them. And it goes beyond just knowing them from a professional perspective. It's really knowing them as a person.
Great. And what other tools and strategies do you use to get good leadership?
Well, from a military perspective, I guess there's lots. It's probably worth drawing on the, and I just mentioned it very briefly, what leaders are, know, do. So the Army's definition of leadership is the character, knowledge, and action that inspires others to succeed. So the character is what leaders are. The knowledge is what they know, and action is what they do. And for us, that's a really useful conceptual framework for understanding how leadership works. And again, I think this is transferable across all organizations. It starts with a character. It starts with who you are as a person and your values and the principles of what you hold dear in life. If you're going to be an effective leader, you've got to have good moral standing, because when you need to make those decisions, they need to be, especially if you're under pressure, they're instinctive, they need to be the right decision. It goes back to my point right at the beginning about that purpose. So character is really important. And that's why, again, in the Army, we talk about our leaders being champions of our values and standards. The Army's values are courage, discipline, respect for others, integrity, loyalty, and selfless commitment. And of course, we need to turn those from lovely words on a page in the corporate brochure into the lived reality, into behaviors every single day. And again, that goes back to context. What does that actually mean here and now for us as a team in this environment, right? So there's the character bit, the knowledge I've already spoken about knowing yourself, your people, your profession. And then what leaders do is the hard part. That's the art of leadership. That's in the everyday. And the framework we use for that is the Venn diagram of task, team, and individual. It's about developing your individuals, getting the best out of them, building your team, and achieving the task. And in brief, it's about maintaining equitable balance between those competing needs, recognizing that you're never going to maintain equitable balance all the time. There'll be times where the task is the absolute focus at the expense of perhaps your individuals or your team, but the leader's responsibility is to repay the debt, be conscious of that, and repay the debt to the other two at an appropriate point in time. The art of leadership is literally in the everyday. I think there's a quote we put in the book about, it's not about the heroic exceptions, it's the everyday, doing what is right, doing what is appropriate, what is necessary every single day to really get after those three elements, achieve the task, build the team, look after individuals.
Yeah, that's a really neat little framework there, task, team, individuals. So you're sort of saying that those three things can sort of be in tension a little bit, I guess, right? So you can be focusing on a task and then sort of, obviously the team's doing it and the individuals are in the team, but that's not the same as focusing on the team or focusing on the individuals, which are also different things. So it's a balance.
Yeah, so there'll be a point when you've got to meet a deadline, you've got to meet a business deadline. You know, the client wants it by this Friday and this is a standard, we need to get it done. And we're going to need to work late and we need to drive this hard. So it's all about the task, and people have to sacrifice the kids' sports day, or the team becomes fractious because they're all tired because they're working late, whatever it may be. But then it's all about delivering on the task, and that's fine. So long as once that task is complete, you then repay the debt to your team and the individuals. You might give people a bit of time off or go and have a brew with them and see how they're doing, or bring the team together, right? What have we learned? How can we do this better next time? Whatever it may be. You know, from a military perspective, you know, going out on the ground, you go on operations, you're in the fight, it's all about the task. You know, literally people's lives are on the line. You can't be worried about conditions of your individuals or your team in that moment, because it's all about the task in front of you. But when you come out, you're out of contact, then you reconstitute the team. Right, have we got everything? Have we got all the resources? Are we good to go? How's morale? Right, let's get on to the next objective. And when you come back to base, then you're refocusing on the individuals, how people are reacting, how they're feeling, are they stressed? What do they need to reset, ready to go out the door the next day? And again, all this is transferable. It's about maintaining the equitable balance over time. Because if you're completely task focused, and you see this in business all the time, it's all about the bottom line. It's all about delivering for the client. People burn out. Teams just fracture. Individuals, they just don't have the sustainability. They don't feel valued. That's why you've got to maintain balance over time.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I think I've definitely seen that over the years. I mean, if a task-oriented focus isn't in and of itself a bad thing. In fact, it can be a good thing. But I get what you're saying, which is it creates a debt in these other areas. But what are some of the little, just really practical examples of those other things? Because is it simply about scheduling time to meet people and talk to them and do stuff? Or are there more kind of frameworks that you can use to help bind the team a bit more and explore those with individuals?
Individual stuff is literally... it's in the small everyday habits, right? It's in those small interactions. Even when you're really focused on the task, it's a look, it's a joke, it's a side conversation. Or when everything's calmed down, you know, you pull someone aside because you notice they're a bit stressed and they weren't performing to their best. You pull them aside, go and have a coffee with them. Or as you're walking out the building, you walk to the car with them. And it's all the small little interactions for people to recognize, okay, the boss or the leader, they care about me. But it's also not just about having those conversations with people and understanding their issues and their perspectives, but doing something about it within your power. So if someone comes to you with a problem or you go to someone, they identify there's an issue, if you've got the ability to do something about it, then help them, because again, that makes them feel valued. That then makes them feel they belong and they're part of the team, and they're going to give you more next time around. They're going to come in fresh the next day because they know that you genuinely care about them. In terms of the team, I mean, there's so many different factors you can do here, but I think it's about drawing the team together. It's making sure you've got clear purpose, obviously. So that is a shared purpose. It's about making sure that everyone is informed, there is shared understanding, and not just within your team, but inevitably in business, increasingly, you're a team of teams. You have other people, other specialists come in from different departments, different companies, you're working with clients. So how do you make them all feel like one team? It's not them and us. How do you break down those barriers? Information sharing, making sure that everyone has the same resources and information necessary to do their job. There's some sort of quick wins, but it's also that sense of identity as well. And this is a sort of a longer conversation and harder to do, but certainly from my experience, what really, really gels a team is this sense of belonging together, this shared identity, that you're part of something special. And I was very fortunate, as I say, to spend the best part of 2 decades in the parachute regiment with this global reputation, this rich history which we draw on. And we do that through our storytelling of the people who have gone before us that have made up what it means to be a paratrooper. And I think if every organization has that sense of who they are and what they're part of, that really binds people together. And businesses do it in different ways, but I think that sense of belonging, being part of special, is a real motivator. And in from a military perspective, we pay a lot of attention to our regimental history, which goes back 360 years, and people literally will fight and die for the badge, for the flag, whatever it is, the regiment they're part of. So it's a huge motivator. And I think if you can translate some of that into a business context, it's very, very powerful. There's a great book by Owen Eastwood, which I've just read. He's a world-class performance coach. It's called Belonging, Unlocking the Potential with the Ancient Code of Togetherness. I'm looking on my desk now. And that's all about that, how you bring that sense of purpose, those values. And he draws his history from, he's a Kiwi, so he draws it from the, you know, he's worked with the All Blacks, England rugby, football, and many other corporations. And that's a really powerful motivator that people have that shared sense of identity.
It's quite intangible, isn't it, in some ways? I mean, obviously, it's really important, but it is quite intangible and sort of tough to pin down, I suppose, and certainly not something you can put in a spreadsheet and, like, create a business plan for. Do you think that's why folks struggle with it a little bit, maybe?
I think they struggle with it, yeah. And leadership's the same, right? It's quite immeasurable, isn't it? These are the things that underpin real success, and this is why people need to sit down and really think about these. You know, where have you come from? What's the history of your company? What's your purpose? What do you really stand for? What are you there to achieve? What are your values? I mean, lots of companies talk about their values, but what do they actually mean to you as an organization? Why have you got these values? Where do they come from? And what do they mean now in the context you're working in? I think these are really important conversations people need to have, and not just have them, let's do a quick workshop and work out what our values are, stick them on there, put them on our website, everyone's happy.
Happens all the time, right?
Happens all the time. But how do you actually translate that? How do you have the conversation with the people? So again, going back to storytelling, it's a really powerful way of doing it. One way we infuse our values and standards is through storytelling. So we put them into different perspectives. So if you're a member of a logistics regiment, vice the parachute regiment, vice the signals regiment, we'll all have different stories and different histories that we draw on to contextualize the same values. So we talk about people who have gone before us and how they've lived our values through our own regimental history. And that then brings that sense of pride and togetherness in your shared history. And you're now part of that continued legacy. But in so doing, you're infused in these, as you say, Dan, these quite intangible concepts of like values and culture and what have you, but they're critical conversations.
I've often said I think culture gets thrown around far too much as a thing. And there's so many firms in our industry will go into a pitch and say, well, of course, the most important things about us are our culture and our people. That is kind of obviously true. It's a truism. But I think often for folks who haven't done the work to actually even begin to understand what that might actually mean and whether they are different and how are they different to competitors, I think is often just not explored as much as it sort of ought to be. I think there ought to be quite a high bar to actually trying to claim that, because you've got to do real work, I think, to actually really understand it.
Yeah, definitely. So there's four areas I often talk about in terms of how you instill culture and the values to being part of that, right? It's how you reward people. And I'm not just talking about financial reward or promotion, but how you reward people in the everyday, saying thank you to someone, writing a letter of thanks, highlighting good work someone done collectively. It's holding people to account. The army hasn't done well on this in the past. If you've got certain standards that you want to maintain as part of your culture, whatever they may be, you're going to hold people to account when they fail to achieve those standards. We all step over the boundaries at some point. You've got to be held to account for them. Storytelling, really, really powerful. The most powerful way is by example. So leaders across the organization, if you say your value is, I don't know, authenticity, or your value is innovation, well, what does that actually mean? Show us the practical examples every single day. And that's where you can't say one thing and then do another. And it's everyone's responsibility. That's what people forget. They think, well, it's the senior's responsibility. It's the executives or it's the directors. It's everyone's responsibility. We all have a piece of the jigsaw that is culture. Everyone has a responsibility.
I feel there's at least two big themes in the modern world of work, right? Obviously, one is remote working. And another, we certainly experience this in our business, is something you alluded to, which is cross-teaming, multi-teaming. So the reality is any given day, we're all part of a lot of different teams. Each of those teams are made up of a lot of people who are across a lot of teams, and we're working remotely as well. And so that seems, on the face of it, to challenge some of what you're saying. I get that when you've got a really motivated group of army people, you're face-to-face, I can sort of start to see how some of this works. But are you finding that from your sort of corporate clients, people you talk to, are they trying to explore how to make this stuff work across a remote interface and with the multi-teaming bit?
So the multi-teaming, yeah. I mean, my whole career has been multi-teaming. When we go on operations, we never go alone. We're always with allies and partners around the world. Or, you know, I worked on the Olympics. We're working with partners across government. We're working with private and public sector. But even within the army, as I'll draw on General McChrystal in a minute, he wrote the book, The Team of Teams. He was the commander of the Coalition Special Forces in Iraq in the fight against Al-Qaeda. Brilliant book, Team of Teams. Some really transferable skills there. And he said, you know, one of the core skills of a leader today, arguably has been for some years now, is the ability to bridge those divides and bring different teams together. And I think, again, I look from a military perspective, the profession of arms has certain cultures and characteristics about it that are replicable around the world. So I can pair up with, you know, I mentored an Afghan colonel in the Afghan army, and instinctively we were brothers in arms. Literally, we were brothers in arms in terms of what we were there. And because we had that sort of baseline understanding of what the profession of arms was about, we had a connection. Now, the cultural differences were vast, let alone the fact we spoke two very different languages. But at every level, I think if you've got foundations that bring you together, so the British Army will have, we've all been through the same training system. We all wear the same uniform. We all share the same doctrine and the same values, whatever it may be. So there's certain foundations that bring us together, and organizations are the same. But that doesn't mean you can't have, in the same way that our different regiments and our different battalions and companies all have different, slightly different ethos and characteristics and subcultures within cultures. It's the same in business. A large organization, you've still got different departments, different functional areas, different branches, but you've got a sort of core understanding that brings you together. And I think those differences are both natural, but also they're complementary because they promote competition as well. But the core is when you come together, those leaders really break down those natural barriers of them and us. I think in terms of the remote working, I think we're in a period of transition to really understand what this means. I still think it's early days. And I also think that every business will have its own view and own perspective based on the needs of that company or that sector. There's obvious value in giving people more freedom and coming into work just for the sake of coming into work. We all realize it's not wholly beneficial, but I think that we are social creatures. We get the best out of being together. And I think being physically together at the appropriate time, focused on the right things together, is really, really important. So I think it needs to be a hybrid approach. It just takes, certainly the remote work takes extra effort and deliberation and focus from leaders going back to your point, Nikki, about knowing your people, to stay connected, to making sure your communication is effective, to make sure they still feel valued, they're being looked after, you understand the pressures they're under, and you've got an eye on what work they're doing, you know, and whether they're delivering to the standards you require. But there's real power in people coming together. We all know that as the intangibles in those offline conversations that really make a difference. So I think it's a balance we're all going to have to navigate over the next few years.
We mentioned before that people make decisions. So how can you ensure that you have the best chance of making the right decision?
That's a good question. And I think you need to understand what the right decision might mean for you. I go back to right at the beginning. When you're under pressure, it goes back to the Kaiman and Tversky's system one and system two thinking, isn't it? So system one, people will know this from thinking fast and slow, but system one is intuitive, often emotional, quick thinking. And system two is slower, more methodical, more logical. Inevitably, you have to ensure that when you're in system one thinking, when you're under pressure and you're making those decisions in the here and now, and time doesn't allow that deliberation, they need to be right. And by that, I mean, not just right in terms of they're delivering the output that you require, but they're morally right as well. And I think that's why I always go back to this, why I said values are so important, because you've got to live with your decision at the end of the day. Right or wrong, you have the information available at the time. That's all you can go on. And hindsight's a wonderful thing, and you'll get loads more information in hindsight. You'll get different perspectives, and that's great. You've got to go with the decision with the information you got at the time. But you also got, in terms of that intuitiveness, you need to know what is the right thing to do. And intuitively, we all know what the right thing to do is. And I think it's being robust enough and having the moral courage, which is what we often talk about, to make that right decision, because you've got to live with that afterwards. So I think that's key. In terms of how you make the right decision, and again, from my experience, a lot of this is in the training. So we often train in the system too. We go through some really logical processes, and we're really robust in terms of our training and education of those. We slow things right down. That allows that to become habitual then, that thought process to become habitual. So that when you're in the moment, you can do it within seconds. Just to get a personal story on that, going back to that Northern Ireland tour. So before I'd met the platoon, I'd arrived and flew into Northern Ireland, and we had to do 2 days of training with some other paratroopers that had come from various other units and career courses and the like. So they were late to the tour as well. We had a couple of days of in-theater, as we call it, in-theater training, the latest threat briefs, etc. And then we had one day of sort of final exercises. They tested us under various conditions. And we had to do one patrol, which was rural into urban. So we were patrolling across open ground. And then we got fired upon by some enemy forces from some houses ahead of us. So we all went into our drills, and I was fresh out of training. So I'd gone through the logical thought process, nice and slow, methodical. So I dived down into cover and got out my notebook and started sketching the ground and going through my slow, methodical decision-making process. And before I knew, literally in seconds, two experienced lance corporals came flying past me. We got this boss literally straight onto the enemy, secured it, did everything. And there was me 2 minutes later, huffing and puffing, putting my helmet on straight, doing up my pockets. Right, what's going on? Don't worry, boss, it's all done. We've covered it. We've got people out here. We've got that secure. The enemy's gone. I was like, oh, great. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And it just dawned on me that, you know, I was still in that methodical process, and it was just instinctive for them because they trained hard. So they knew the right decisions to make in that context because they drilled it so often. So I think there's an element of practice to make good decisions as well. And that comes with experience, right?
So you're saying it's process, it's habitualizing it, it's drilling it. But I guess a fundamental to all of that, you've got to have and I think the army call it a doctrine that you're working from, right?
Absolutely.
It feels like a slightly loaded word to me, the word doctrine, for some reason. But I don't know, it feels a bit like a sort of set in stone instead of diktats kind of thing. Anyway, you need to have some kind of template that you're working from, because if you're drilling something different, it's not going to really work. And there is also the sense, I guess, that you all have to have obviously worked from the same one, ideally together over time, so that you can then put it into practice together, right? So it's quite a lot of bits there.
Yeah, again, there's some intuitive stuff. We all know intuitive decision-making, but you have to fall back on, you're right, doctrine, process. I agree with the word. It's a framework for thinking. It doesn't tell people what to think, it teaches people how to think. But you're absolutely right. And another very quick example, I was the operations officer for Defence's Crisis Response Headquarters, and we were doing this large-scale exercise abroad, and we had some senior officers there. I had about 50 people in the room, and I was the operations guy. We had people forward in some Middle Eastern countries working with the embassies. And this was exercising real-time contingency plans for evacuation of British personnel from various countries. And we had intelligence agencies with us. We had charities, Red Cross and others. So it was a big exercise. And I remember one day there was about two or three scenarios that were thrown in and it was all going wrong. I distinctly remember the room just falling silent and everyone looking at me. What's your decision? And I just literally froze. It felt like minutes, it would have been seconds, but I literally froze. And there was a senior retired Lieutenant General, Tim Evans, wonderful man. He was standing next to me. He was mentoring my boss. And he came up, tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Langley, the fog has descended." And he could just tell that my face was overwhelmed with information. And he said, "Right, first things first, what are you here to do? What is your mission?" And we've got this 10 principles of war. The master principle of war is the selection and maintenance of the aim. So what are you there to do? And then focus on that. So I can't remember what it was. Right, I'm here to do this. Good, right. What do you need? What are your priorities to get after that single aim? This, this, and this. Good, good. Okay, and back to your point, Dan, about sort of systems and processes and what we call standard operational procedures. He said, right, go to your book. And there it was in front of me. Turn to page whatever, and there's your flowchart. Right, helicopter down, mass casualties. Follow the flowchart. So we had processes which everyone understood. And within minutes, I was off making decisions. I knew where I was going. I just took that condor moment to think, right, what is this? Lift the fog, step back, deep breath, and then you're back into your processes. So really it's that blend, as you say, of process and order and practice with that intuitive nature that all road leaders have.
Would you say in situations like that, it helps to acknowledge the emotion, so to acknowledge the apprehension to get over it?
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got to be honest with yourself. You know, we all have it. No matter how senior you are, I think everyone will admit they have their moments of doubt, imposter syndrome, of uncertainty. We've all been there, and those that haven't align or say they haven't. We've all been in situations where we're emotionally tested for sure. And in terms of your emotions, going back to self-awareness, we were talking about earlier on about knowing yourself. It's about knowing how you operate under pressure and how you can operate most effectively. We often talk about, you know, that particular exercise, I hadn't slept properly for 3 days. I wasn't functioning properly because physically and therefore sort of, you could argue emotionally, psychologically, I wasn't on top form. We talk about self-care, of eating well, sleeping well, exercising well. That's all part of it. But yeah, you've got to acknowledge that your, overused word now, but your vulnerabilities and how you overcome those.
Yeah, I guess that ability to recognize the fog when it's coming down is probably something that a lot of folks will sort of resonate with a little bit, obviously in quite different situations, but I'm sure we've all been in situations where you kind of realize things have got a little bit chaotic and someone has to find a way to step back and cut through it all. And the best way to do that, I guess, is, yeah, like you say, it's back to objectives, it's back to a process that we all know and can kind of follow.
Just quickly, Dan, rely on your team as well, right? You don't have to have all the answers. The reality is in this complex world, the fast-paced world that we operate in, you're not going to know the senior person in the room is not going to know all the answers. So there will times, absolutely, people turn to you and say, right, make a decision, and you have to step up, right? But where possible, you use your team. And in that particular instance I just described, yes, I gave some direction that got everyone going, but thereafter, the people that were solving these various issues were the team. And I was just providing direction for them to take that forward. So yeah, it's really important.
Yeah, but that's the sort of thing I was going to come on to, actually. So to get into some of these real practicalities of how you think good decisions get made. I mean, have you got views on things like what's the right size of a decision-making group? What's the right size of a team? How to sense when you need more information or when you've got enough information and you need to act? All those things are quite crucial in our world, but I can see that maybe a little bit transferable.
Yeah, the size is a difficult one. I mean, we have a clearly structured organization. We work in almost in blocks, really, a section of 8 people, a platoon of 30, a company of 100. And these go back to, you know, Roman times or whatever the history tells us. So decision-making is so contextual, depending on how many people you need to make the decisions. So I'm not sure about size. Let me come back to that. I think there's definitely a good conversation to have about, you know, when you make decisions. So again, from an army perspective, we value decision-making. For obvious reasons, because we need people who can make decisions under immense pressures when life's on the line in the extremis. And therefore, historically, and we still do, we recruit and hire people that can make decisions. I think we have a bias for decision making, which is not a bad thing. We often told you, make a decision, right or wrong, just make a decision. So I think there are real advantages to that. But I also think there are disadvantages in that people are often too quick to make a decision because they feel they have to, because that's what they're being trained to do. And they need to be decisive. They need to make a decision and go forward, right? Firstly, if you've got a decision to make, the first thing to think, is this my decision? Some practical realities here. Is this my decision? Maybe the decision has to go up rather than down or yourself, right? So maybe you delegate upwards, or most of the time you may be able to delegate downwards. And really what you want to do to get the best out of your organization is delegate decision making as low as practically possible. And what that does then, by delegating, it doesn't delegate you from the responsibility of those decisions, but it frees you up for thinking about other issues, what you as you really need to worry about, which only sit with you. So is it yours to make? And then the next question is, when do I need to make the decision? Do I have to make it now? And if not, when can I make it? Can I make it in a couple of minutes? Can I make it tomorrow? Can I make it in a month's time? And what information or what else do I need in order to make that decision? And where do I get that from? And also, if I do delay, what are the potential implications? We've lost the opportunity, or actually I'm going to get more information, so I'm going to make a more informed opinion. So I think there's a certain element of that process of understanding, you know, who and when to make the decision before you actually go forward with it. Because I often think that quick decision-making is useful, but it can be a disadvantage to the organization if everyone's making quick decisions. I worked with a bank recently, and pretty much everyone in the room was saying they are decision makers. They're hired to make decisions. And the whole exercise we were doing was slowing that down, listening to others and getting wider perspective in order to make a more informed decision. Because the science will tell you an individual decision will give you whatever, 80% reliability, whatever it may be. A team decision will give you 66%. A diverse team will give you 70, whatever percent. You know, the more collaboration you can have, diverse perspectives you can bring on a decision, the better, if time allows. Just to finish this bit with, maybe listening to Sir Graham Lamb, who's an ex-director of Special Forces, senior general, works and is held in very high regard with our American counterparts. I remember listening to him on the podcast, and he cited Einstein's quotes that's often batted around about, if I had an hour to make a life-changing decision, I would spend 55 minutes understanding the problem and 5 minutes defining the solution. And Graham said, from his reality, people spend 59 minutes trying to find a solution and a minute blaming everyone else when it all goes wrong. And I think therein lies the problem with certain institutions, military being one, where we really focus on providing solutions and we don't often sit back and really think about the problem.
And that's a really good point. Action bias is something that gets talked about a lot in investing for exactly that reason, that it's very, very tempting to be constantly making decisions about investing and changing your portfolio and stuff like that. And often it's actually not the right thing to do, but there's so many reasons why organizations are set up in ways that sort of incentivize people to lead in that way. And so leaning against it is the real key.
And the pace of change within the markets as well. You know, people talk about risk and opportunity. And if the opportunity is there, you need to make a quick decision to exploit that opportunity. Otherwise, the market dynamics may change and may lose it. So you can understand why there is a bias for that. Of course, it has a knock-on effect that people don't really understand the problem they're dealing with and therefore not coming forward with the appropriate solutions and therefore the appropriate decisions.
Are you sort of saying there that framing the output of a decision then can help to form it in a faster way?
Yeah, again, all time dependent. And that's why you need to do the quick analysis of when do you actually need to make this decision. But I just think generally we have, as Dan said, that bias for action, which is an absolute intrinsic part of a high performance team, having that bias for action. So there's no doubt. But I also think that we need to have a better appreciation of the complexity of the problems that we're dealing with. And as the markets, the world, the societies we operate in are becoming ever more interconnected, ever more complex and harder to understand, the ability to understand them in the first place and to put your decision-making into context is ever more important. And that's where, I'm no expert on this, but I think that's where technology will increasingly play its role, is in aiding that decision-making for us, because the human mind can only go so far, even collectively. So I think that fusion of human brain power and technology in the future will be a really interesting dynamic to make an effective decision making.
And do you log decisions so that you can evaluate them later on, look for things that could have been done better?
Yeah, certainly on operations. By way of an example, in the operations room, you have an operational logbook. Every decision that's made, the conversations that happen are logged down. So you have a diary of the events. Happens less so in training, for example, but certainly on operations, everything is logged, so you can go back and analyze those. I do think that some organizations are very good at learning. I think the military has still got a way to go. I think it's had a bit of a step change in the last 20 years, but I think it's still got a long way to go in terms of being a genuinely good learning organization. To your wider point, if you're going to evolve, if you're going to stay ahead of the competition, you've got to really have some honest debates about what you've done well and what you haven't done well. And again, you look at any high performance team, they'll do that superbly. And there are parts of the military I see it doing superbly. But I think culturally, we're not as good as we ought to be in terms of learning from our past.
It's hard though, right? I mean, I was going to ask, I mean, when you go back and review those logs of the decisions in your exercises or whatever, how painful is it sometimes to look at the stuff that you said or did or whatever that was maybe doesn't look so great afterwards? That's the issue, isn't it? It can be quite psychologically tough to go back and look at those. I think this is why a lot of people bias not to.
Yeah, I think there's lots of reasons why we don't. I think there's the practical realities of life is so fast nowadays. You're literally on to the next task. And when do you have time to analyze and then work out what the lessons are and then bring them into change of the way you do things? But yeah, the other thing is it's difficult, isn't it? As you say, Dan, when you're in the moment, you act as the situation dictates. And when you're in a nice, cool, warm operations room or wherever you may be, in your conference room, back in the office afterwards, when everything's calmed down, the emotions have calmed down, you've got a warm cup of coffee in your hand, you can analyze things far more rationally. And I think you've got to be honest with yourself that they are two different environments and you've got to try and see it through the lens of being in the moment rather than, as we said earlier, the wonders of hindsight. And I think that's why other sort of more generally organizations, teams, organizations, certainly in the public space, suffer from outside scrutiny that's not seen within context, you know, trial by social media, or everyone's got an opinion. And often those opinions are seen from a very different context. People that haven't actually lived the reality and been in the moment. Those outside perspectives, I think, are important for organizations to stop homogenous thinking. But I also think that we need to appreciate that, going back to your point, when decisions are made in the heat of the moment, that they're within a certain context and that it needs to be understood. That context really needs to be understood.
Before we hit the wrap up, I was really intrigued on a slightly different note. Any notable sort of leadership situations playing out globally right now in politics or business or geopolitics or whatever that you're watching with interest because you think it's an interesting demonstration of some of these things?
I guess the broader point, I go back to collaboration. In fact, I was having a conversation with someone earlier on this week about similar issues. So if you're talking about a global perspective and geopolitics and the like, I guess one of the tensions we're all facing at the moment is the interconnectivity of some of the big issues we're dealing with, whether it be supply chains, financial markets, war in Europe. We are more connected than ever before. And therefore, to deal with these global issues and global crises in some instances that affect us all, we need collaboration. We need to work together to find solutions. We can't do this alone, whatever alone means. The flip side of that, the tension there is the competing, almost insular perspective, insular thinking. By that, I mean national self-interest. You know, I saw this playing out in Afghanistan. The coalition was 52, I think, or certainly over 50 nations strong at its height. So real strength in that coalition. But trying to drive a coherent strategy really tested our senior decision makers because they had to deal with 50 plus different national caveats and national interests and national perspectives. And I think we've got that arguably it'll ever be thus. But, and again, going back to McChrystal's point about modern leaders need to bridge the gap between teams and pull people together. That will be, I think, globally, one of the biggest challenges. Citing a specific example, you look at Ukraine now, and the divergence in opinion of how much we, the West, and more broadly now, should support our Ukrainian partners with arms and ammunition and support. And there are differences of opinion. Whether Ukraine should cede ground to Russians as part of a peace dividend. Again, different nations will have different perspectives because competing political agendas back home. And that's really, really difficult. So I think looking out the next 12 months, an obvious one, and parochial with my background perspective, is where is Ukraine going? Global impact. Is there going to be that endurance of support from the wider international coalition to support them? And it's going to take leadership to pull people together and to keep them focused on that critical task.
It's been a really fascinating talk today. If there's one thing you would want listeners to take away from all of it, which would you highlight?
It goes back to what we're saying about the fundamentals of leadership. I think it's important that we all appreciate how central leadership is to delivering high performance in whatever sector you are. And I would say that now as a running leadership consultancy, but my 25 years of experience says that if you're going to get the very best out of your people, you're going to deliver the very best for your organization at whatever level, you need effective leadership. It's the force multiplier. And to get there, you have to invest in it. You have to invest your time and effort because it takes time, effort, and the daily grind to get it right.
And what do you think is the most underappreciated thing in general about this whole area?
It's probably that point that leadership, because it is, as you said, Dan, because it is quite intangible, it is underappreciated. Because it's not measurable, it's hard to measure the impact of it. We all know it. We've all been part of a team, a sports team, a club, an organization, a business. We've all been part of a team that is performing at its best, where everyone feels like they're pulling in the same direction. Everyone feels like they're adding value and they're delivering outstanding results. It's tangible. You can feel it. And leadership and good followership that sit side by side, they're intertwined. I think that vastly underestimated. And I say that because I see so much lack of leadership in all sectors and a lack of investment in genuine leadership development across all levels of organizations. And I think if we all focus on that a little bit more, then not just business will thrive, but society will be far better for it.
Amazing. Other than your book, do you have any other books or podcasts to recommend?
I mentioned one, Owen Eastwood's Belonging. I think it's brilliant. That my go-to book that I often quote from is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl. It's one of the most compelling books I've ever read. An Austrian psychiatrist who was Jewish and was taken captive by the Nazis in World War II, spent 3 years in Auschwitz and other concentration camps. And he wrote an utterly compelling book about finding your purpose and the importance of freedom and responsibility. It's a wonderful book. In terms of podcasts, I would say a good friend of mine, Jeremy Snape, who's helped me since I've left the army, provided me a bit of mentorship. His podcast, In the Mind of Champions, is brilliant. And he speaks to leaders across very many different sectors, sort of elite performance. And it's not just the quality of the conversation, but the analysis that Jeremy draws out of it as well. So that's one I recommend.
It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation today. Could have gone on for ages and ages on this. But Langley, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Nikki. Much appreciate the opportunity.
Our podcast is for information and marketing purposes only and does not constitute any form of investment or financial advice. For more information, please refer to our marketing privacy policy on the LCP website.